Most of us know how we ought to be. We ought to be cool in a crisis, positive when things go wrong, emotionally consistent with our loved ones, able to break bad habits and take on new, constructive ones. Well, the list is really long. But we know these things. Why can't we just do them? I'm Susan McGinnis, and for KUAC FM in Fairbanks, this is Conversations. My guest today is Dr. Bobby Sommer, a clinical psychologist whose career is devoted to helping people, both in business and in their personal lives, find ways to get more done with less effort, to reduce conflicts, to build self-esteem, and enjoy the lives we're living. For the next hour, sit back and enjoy with me a conversation with Dr. Bobby Sommers. Dr. Sommer, is that accurate, that there's a wide gulf between what we know and what we can do?
Unfortunately, it seems to be for a lot of us. I mean, we know a lot of things, but making ourselves do it is something else. And the making, really kind of forcing ourselves to change habits, is very tough to do. You know, once a habit is entrenched, it's entrenched. Mm-hmm. And so we fall into patterns of procrastinating, putting things off, unpleasant things, that kind of stuff. And yeah, even though we know we should be doing it, one of the best examples I have is the New Year's resolution list. You know, we all know that, and we all have good intentions.
And these are all things I can do.
Yeah,
right?
And sure. they're all feasible. They're all within a range of grasp. But people just they lose interest. It's too hard. I don't want to diet anyway. And then they find friends that'll support them and say, "You're right. You look fine. Don't lose any more weight." So we justify that which we really want for ourselves. Uh-huh. So there is a huge gulf between what we know we can do, that is our potential, and what we're really putting forth and really energizing ourselves to do, which is not that much for most of us.
Are we in? I was wondering this when I was thinking about talking with you today. Are we also in some ways deluded about how much we know? This was my example. I've been smoking for forever, and I know I should quit. When I was looking today at that habit and thinking about talking with you, I was thinking, well, maybe I don't know all the things I need to know to get me from the point where I'm smoking or someone else with a point where he or she is overeating or procrastinating to the actual point where we're beyond that habit we no longer want to have.
Yeah, well, I guess there's a huge chasm between the knowingness about what's good and bad for us and being a slave to a habit. Mm. Somebody once said it takes a lot more perspiration than inspiration to change a habit. And most people either change a habit either through inspiration or desperation. And you see that happening a lot. So it isn't always the amount of information I accrue that I know. It's what I'm able to do and translate that into my real life, honest to goodness, cause and effect. So if, say, for some reason, I had a patient not too long ago who heavy-duty smoker for many, many years and really had a horrible bout of viral pneumonia to the point where she really could not smoke. It was physically not possible for her to do that for many, many weeks. And when she finally came out of the CCU ward and ICU wards and talked to her, because she'd been in there for a long time, she literally had a plant growing in her lungs. It's one of these really weird things, you know. And she, at that point, out of desperation, she said, "I'll never smoke again." Now, they couldn't say your smoking caused this to happen, but they did say because your lungs were in a very weakened condition anyway, it sure didn't help an awful lot. So I think with her, it took like a real connection between all the years she had known, and, you know, the Surgeon General tells us all this good stuff about smoking and so forth. But suddenly, I think it always has to be a personal thing for a lot of people. And then suddenly that knowing becomes very entrenched in our fiber. And then it means something to us. It has real true meaning for us.
It branches out to the emotional, spiritual, physical, as well as the intellectual knowledge of...
Absolutely. You know. Sure. Huh. Absolutely. Yeah. So sometimes just knowing something, we can accrue a lot of information and a lot of knowledge about a lot of topics, but until we can really attach to it, until it really has an emotional connection, we don't usually do much with that.
Mm-hmm. This is Conversations. We're talking today with Dr. Bobby Sommer. Two things you'll want to know about my guest today. She is a psychological eclectic, that is to say that she takes from a number of psychological systems. One that we'll talk about in the next hour is Ellis's rational emotive therapy. And also, she is rewriting a book that was extremely popular in self-help books, put out in 1960 for the first time, Psycho-Cybernetics by Dr. Maxwell Maltz. That she's rewriting and updating this book to be known as Psycho-Cybernetics 2000.
Right? That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Both Albert Ellis and Dr. Maxwell Maltz talked about belief systems.
Right.
And how they enhance or get in our way. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about that? How does that happen?
Sure. Well, the word belief, first of all, has the word lie inside of it. There's a L-I-E, it's part of our belief system. And we have a lot of lies in our belief system. And whether you take it from a rational motive point of view or from Dr. Maltz's point of view, the same thing applies. Is that once we subconsciously believe something about ourselves, i.e. self-esteem, self-image, whatever you want to call that stuff, once we get that really concretized in our minds, it seems to pretty much run our lives. And so if I really believe that what I was told as a child, you're just like your Aunt Martha. Hmm. You're just like your Uncle Tony. And, of course, he did 4 years in the state pen, you know.
That made you feel good.
Yeah, right. Or, you know, you're just like your father, bad blood. We are inundated and bombarded with all this stuff. And so Maxwell Maltz presented the idea back in 1960, what he called a servo mechanism. Mm-hmm. He likened it to a heat-seeking missile. To put it in our terms current today would be the patriot that seeks out scuds, a scudbuster kind of thing. And once you set something in that direction, it will go for that target every time. And so Maltz made the equation that probably that's how our mind works, that the subconscious mind will begin to seek out anything you point it toward. But it has to have a conscious target first to hit, then it'll go for it. So that's why he said our beliefs are so important, because our beliefs will dictate how we'll set our targets toward success, toward failure. If I really believe that I'm never going to amount to anything anyway, I'll set very low standards for myself, probably. If I believe that I'm gifted or I'm talented or I have all these skills, I'll probably set my goals a bit differently. So that was his point of view. Now, Ellis takes a similar point of view, but he says that our beliefs dictate whether we are rational or irrational thinkers. And so he talks about what he called the four irrational thinking styles. And he said those are the four styles that make people unhappy, or if you want to use his terms, neurotic. I mean, to me, neurosis is when I make myself miserable. That's a real neurotic thing to do to myself. And so he said there's four basic states. One, he said, is called demanding. And demanding is saying that it should be this way. You know, why God, why me? I, by golly, want this. I've earned it. I need it. And demanding from the universe is something be so. And the next he called awfulizing. Oh, this is awful. It's terrible. It's just, why me? You know, this going on and kind of exploding with how terrible life really is. Then the third one he called awfulizing. Oh, no, I can't stand it, itis. Where he said, I can't stand it. This is terrible. I just can't stand this. And, of course, his rational point of that is, of course you can stand it. You're still mm-hmm. alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you couldn't stand it, you wouldn't be here. So he talks about those three. And then the last one he called condemning and damning, that something's gone wrong in my life.
Somebody else's fault.
Of course. Yeah. It's always your fault because, gee whizzes, and you made me do that, and you said that, and therefore, you know, one of the classic lines of all time in psychology is, now see what you made me do. You just kept on to made me hit you or whatever. And so people justify and rationalize it. So it all comes from either a faulty belief system or a healthy belief system. But I think a lot of us fall into that. Well, Ellis had some cute terms for it. He said, you know, the word should. He said, don't should on yourself today. We have this propensity to say, oh, I should have. And not, it would have been nicer had I. Or looking back, that would have been more, been smarter had I done it this way. But people tend to say, I should, or I must, or I ought to, or I have to, or I got to. And there's really nothing much we have to do in life. They're all choices.
And all those shoulds put us automatically into a negative read on whatever it is we're doing or someone else is doing, and so we get stuck in the place where things are wrong.
Exactly.
Which is what both Maltz and Ellis were talking about.
Right.
Just getting stuck in the place where things are not right.
Exactly. Yeah. And then once we get stuck in that place, we wallow in it, first of all, and then we either blame and point fingers and say, well, it's your fault I'm here. If it weren't for you, I wouldn't be in this situation. If only I had married... if only I had gone back to school, if only, the if only game runs a lot of people's lives.
Everybody listening must have heard these or said these once. I mean, they all come home. Sure.
I've said them myself. Yeah. You know, and because we get into the self-pity thing, the pity pot routine, I call it, sitting in the pity pot and feeling sorry for ourselves. And, of course, then the more we do that, the more we validate that I have every right to feel sorry for myself. And, you know, this is not to say that people don't have bad things happen to them. We all have bad things happen. And life is a mixed bag. But I think the point that Ellis drives home very clearly is that if our expectation rate is that life should be fair and I should get a fair shake in life, then I'll walk around chronically disappointed because life isn't fair and it's not unfair. It just is. It's for quite neutral. Life doesn't really care. He gives the example of someone standing in line and really being angry. And, of course, the longer they stand in line, the angrier they get. And they say, boy, this line should move, and I should really change banks, and this is ridiculous. And the person's already kind of steamed up anyway, all the shoulds going on. Then, of course, somebody steps in front of this person. Now there's a double way. Now not the person's just saying it should, but now it's I can't stand it-itis. How dare you? Who do you think you are? And demanding and awfulizing. And then condemning and damning, you know. This person should be condemned. How dare they? Who do they think they are? That whole kind of thing. So it becomes a real convoluted situation. Once we get into that, it just there's just seemingly like a loop within a loop. We keep going around with that stuff.
These things that you're describing have come out of our mouths over and over in our lives, mm-hmm. or maybe we're stuck in them. I mean,
right.
Either come out
right.
at one point or we're stuck in them. Both Ellis and Maltz talk about ways to pull yourself out, mm-hmm. ways to help you. And I think the first step each of them says is you have to recognize that you're doing it.
That's right. You have to become consciously aware of a habit you have formed over the years. And then you have to have the wherewithal inside of yourself to care enough about yourself or about the situation to do something to change that. And again, sometimes a lot more inspiration, I mean, perspiration than inspiration. You just got to get out there and do things.
Stick-to-itiveness.
Yeah, and follow through and make it happen because we get stuck in these ridiculous habits. And sometimes we've been doing them for so long, they no longer feel like a habit. They feel so natural. And one of the examples I give, and I'll have you do it with me, just clasp your hands. Okay. Do you think that's a conscious or an unconscious act?
Clasping my hands?
Mm-hmm.
The physical act
mm-hmm.
of it?
Mm-hmm.
No, the physical act of it is, I don't think it is conscious.
No, it's not. It's totally unconscious.
Right.
But most people think it's really a conscious act. But if you look and see what you've done, see which thumb is resting on top. Some people have their left on top, some have their right on top. So I tell people this is really a very unconscious act. Now, for the listener at home, if they want to just try this, it's kind of fun. Clasp your hands and look down and see which of your index fingers is nearest to your body.
Weave your fingers is what
mm-hmm.
she's saying. So weave our fingers.
Right.
Which is closest to the body.
Right. So if your left index finger is nearest to your body or your right, then simply reverse them and interlace your fingers the opposite way all the way down the line and put the other thumb on top and hold that.
The old church and steeple thing.
Uh-huh.
All right. Yeah.
Uh-huh. To you, how does that feel?
Awkward.
Of course, because you just made it conscious. You had to break a habit.
Because my habit is to weave in only one way.
Right.
So weaving in the... I can't even do it now.
See, exactly.
Yeah, I see.
So, you know, for the people listening at home, if you find yourself in a rut, just clasp your hands and then make yourself physically pull them apart and reclasp them the opposite way around to remind yourself that you have to do something differently and it's not going to feel comfortable the first time. So one of the things that both Ellis and Maltz say is that something can feel very right and intellectually you can know it's very wrong or just the opposite. So we can experience simultaneously, the emotive side, rational emotive. Rational, of course, means, you know, a thought process.
Linear thought through,
illogical. Emotive means feelings. So we can actually think one thing and have a whole different set of experiences going on in our feeling realms. And so usually that's how people get real confused about how to change a habit. Because if you only listen to your emotions, well, this just feels right. I mean, I've been doing this all my life, and my mother did it, my grandmother did it, and the whole family. And so, therefore, we justify. And so we stay stuck, and that's why people do things like say, well, I can't help it. When I get mad, I just scream. My whole family screamed. Oh, I come from this lineage and this part of the world, and people always did this. And so I just explode, and that's okay, because that's how I've always done it. And, you know, that really is not okay because people pay a real high price for that, and not just for themselves, but people around them don't have to want to hear this thing, too. So people get stuck in those habit patterns and justifying that the longer I do it, the more right it becomes. And it doesn't. It doesn't make it any more right today than it was 10 years ago.
Once again, we're talking to Dr. Bobbi Sommer. Dr. Sommer took her BA from the University of Colorado at Boulder, master's from UCLA, and then her PhD was from the California Graduate Institute, which has a Freudian orientation and was the orientation on which she began to build her career as a clinical psychologist. One of the things that Dr. Maxwell Maltz, who, if you don't know about him, he was a plastic surgeon when he started out, and he noticed that some people with scars physically didn't have scars inside, and some people from whom he'd removed physical scars stayed hugely scarred inside, and that was the key to the door that eventually created Psycho-Cybernetics, the book that was so popular. One of the things he posits early in the book is that your self-image is all, because that is the engine that will get you down the road or into the ditch. And then he says, if you are going to get on the road from the ditch or get onto a freeway, if that's where you want to go, you have to change that self-image. And I found myself wondering how hard it is for us even to look at the self-image.
Absolutely.
This is not an easy task.
No, it isn't, because it's so ingrained so early on in our lives. We have accepted it as fact. And one of the things in which in the book I'm writing called Psycho-Cybernetics 2000 is I make some general statements about how the subconscious and the conscious mind work, because people don't really understand the differences. The conscious mind has two principles by which it operates. One is called the agreement principle. And anything it hears, it says, that's right. So if you've been told as a child, I'm not going to give you piano lessons. You have a tin ear. There's no point. You can't draw a straight line, so don't even try. You never were very good in math. If we hear these things after a while, the subconscious mind says, that's right, that's right. And then later on as adults, this is just has been so ingrained in our subconscious minds, we accept that as being absolute fact, and we'd never refute it.
I'm not that kind of person. I don't do math.
Exactly, exactly. And when I do it very poorly. So, therefore, I just have given it up.
Bill does it for me.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Right. And so the subconscious mind, number one, agrees. And then number two, it begins to move in the direction that the conscious mind directs it. And the real catch here is that whether you mean to or not, it doesn't make any difference. The subconscious mind will simply go, like Malt said, that heat-seeking missile. Once it gets a target in mind, it will continue on that path, whether it's, you know, plus or minus, whether it's going to be destructive or instructive for the individual. They'll keep on doing it. And one of the examples I give in the book is my older son, when he was 15 and a half, got a thing called a driver's permit. And if you've ever had a kid with a driver's permit, you know what that's about. And I was helping him drive the car. So, of course, I was on the passenger side. He was on the driver's side. And I always tell people, if you ever notice how close that right-hand curb looks when you get a 15-and-a-half-year-old kid behind the wheel? So we're driving along, and I said to him, you're awfully close to the curb. Watch it. And the next thing I said is, you know, hey, I'm serious. You're really pretty close. You're hugging this curb. Now, be sure you watch this. And the third thing I think I said is, will you please watch the curb? And, of course, at that point, he smashed the hubcap right into the curb. And I'll never forget, I looked at him and I said, what are you doing? You know, what is wrong with you? And he looked at me and he said, I'm watching the curb. So he bears out the principle that the subconscious mind agrees and starts to move toward the things we think about. So that's a very ingrained part of us. So when Maltz was saying, if you're driving down that road, whether you go toward the ditch or you go toward the freeway, a lot will depend upon what your subconscious mind has been programmed to do and what you're listening to in the environment or what you pick out of the environment as well. It's very powerful for us.
How do we begin to dredge that out? How do we begin to make it conscious so we know, oh, I remember, Mother told me I had a tin ear. That's right. Well, I'm not sure anymore whether I have a tin ear or not.
Exactly. How do we begin to really dispute and refute some of the ideas that have ingrained us for many years? Well, there's also two principles that the conscious mind uses. The first principle the conscious mind uses is selection. In other words, you and I selected to be in this room right now to do this program. So when we did that, we eliminated having dinner. Or we did that. We selected a certain place to be. If a person goes into a theater and they select a chair in the 12th row, number E, they've automatically eliminated all the other chairs in that room because they made a selection. So the selection principle says you choose one thing over another. You go to a restaurant, you choose something from the menu you want. So the first principle is, of course, it's very selective. Number two is the principle of elimination, that by definition, if you choose one thing, you eliminate the things in your life. So if you're going to start to change how you perceive yourself, you have to select a certain target that you want to go for. For example, let's say I had a patient not too many years ago who really believed that he was not capable of moving ahead in his career. And when we kind of uncovered and talked more about where that came from, he said something about, well, that's about as far as I can go in life. And I said, well, where'd you hear that?
Why?
He said, well, everyone knows that. I said, well, who's everyone? Well, and of course, what came out later was that's what my father had told me. You know, you'll be doggone lucky if you can get to this point in your life, but never push for it. You know, don't push yourself that far because we don't want you to be disappointed. You know, the old thing about I think a lot of us have been over-cautioned about, don't count your chickens mm-hmm. before they hatch, look before you leap, settle for what you have, that kind of thing. And so he has so ingrained in his belief system that once he got to a middle managerial position, he had better settle for what he had and be grateful and not push too far ahead and thus be disappointed with his life. So it took him, he had to really select then certain things to do with his life to allow him to move past that arbitrary line that had been drawn so many years ago.
And are those barriers bigger because the line was drawn for most of us
years ago? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's sometimes what I call a double whammy. It makes it that much harder to change because we've been telling ourselves that for so many years that to change that is like going against every fiber in our being. It's like changing your hand mm-hmm. clasp. It mm-hmm. just feels so awkward to do that. And the people, here again, even though I will call this person John, when John and I were talking during therapy, and he was there for about 6 months off and on once a week. And even when he began to really do and become more mm-hmm. successful, he said, well, I know I'm more successful. I see my paycheck, so I know that's so. So his intellect was saying, this is really okay. But his so-called gut was still saying, but it doesn't feel right. And so we explored what is your so-called gut telling you? And he was coming up with things like, it's only a question of time.
Yeah.
You know, he was mm-hmm. waiting for the other shoe to fall. And if we really stop and think about how we've been conditioned from our childhood, we've been told this time and time and time again. And I tell people one of the measures of seeing what is really in your subconscious mind is to listen to how many times you open up your mouth and out comes a parent. You know, out comes these things you swore you'd never say to another living, breathing human being. You know, things like, can't you get anything between that in that thick skull of yours? What's wrong with you anyway? That whole kind of condemning and blaming situation. So it's tough to change. It's doable. It's just not easy. And I think a lot of the concepts that particularly Maxwell Maltz taught are very, very simple, mm-hmm. Really simplistic. And simple does not translate to easy. And I think that's where a lot of people get real hung up on self-help books, is that because a concept is so simple. I mean, you look at it intellectually and say, well, that makes good sense. I can do that. So it looks very simple, and it is very simple, but the assumption is because it's simple, it's going to be easy. And au contraire, it's not easy. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to continually keep yourself into a place you can change a habit. And it's doable. It's very doable.
I liked Maltz's illustration of the heat-seeking missile.
Yeah.
Because the other thing he said about it is that if we think it goes zooming straight towards its target, we are in error. What it does is continually adjust. Like you with your son, only more successfully. A little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right. And he used that as a springboard to tell his readers that the heat-seeking missile makes mistakes all the time.
Right.
And the human being, ever so much more fragile, makes mistakes all the time.
Right. And it was, his point was so beautifully taken. It's a self-correcting mechanism. And he would say that the second a missile is launched, a rocket is launched, the second it leaves the pad, it's off course. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, other factors come up, winds, heat, whatever. And so the missile is constantly in a state of self-correcting. And that's exactly what he was saying about the human being. He said, you know, don't fault yourself if you fall back into an old habit. Just say, well, that's something that's feedback to me. And I can either beat myself up about that, or I can say, okay, that's just vital information coming in for me, and now I will choose to, and one of the terms I use in my book is next time. Hmm. Next time, I will choose. Next time, I'll point in this. And if people will keep telling themselves, next time I'll move toward that, it really implants a very strong subconscious message that you will, in fact, do something a little bit different next time.
And follow through on that.
Right. And not get stuck back. And what happens, unfortunately, we get what I call a double whammy. You know, we started to change something. So you say, okay, I'm going to cut back on a cigarette a day or two or whatever. And you start out really well for the first day or two or three or 2 weeks or whatever. And then crisis hits or whatever. And for whatever reason, we go back to, we eat more, whatever, you know, whatever our habit is. And then we say, oh, I knew I couldn't do it.
Self-fulfilled
mm-hmm. prophecy. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, why even bother? Why try? I tried for 2 weeks, didn't work, so that just proves I can't do it. And then we get into the syllogistic reasoning, which, of course, doesn't make any sense, but we all fall into it to justify having to face a change. You see, anytime you break a habit, you're requiring yourself to change, and nobody really wants to change because it's very scary.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about John, your man in middle management. Every step he must have taken out of middle management must have been at least immediately horrifying.
Absolutely. It's amazing how these so-called belief tapes in our head, you know, we have like this little micro tape in our head that keeps spinning around, and it keeps playing back this stuff to us because we have what I call an intra-psychic dialogue. We always talk to ourselves. We never shut up. We talk to ourselves in waking states. We call that thinking. Talk to yourselves in sleeping states, and that's called dreaming. But as long as we have any activity in our brain, as long as we can hook you up to an EEG, electroencephalogram, and read out your brain, we're always talking to ourselves. And a lot of that is internalized dialogue from parental or whomever taught us about life. And it's tough to turn those tapes off. And I'll give you a great example. There was another fellow I saw in therapy, and he was a very bright, articulate man. He was coming in for some post-divorce counseling in what we call a very easy case. He had no in-depth neurosis, but he was going through some changes. Now, during the course of our sessions, he needed to go to small claims court, and so he had to cancel his appointment. Fine, no problem. And he came back the next week visibly shaken, and I said to him, you know, what's going on, Ray? He said, I don't know. He said, I went to small claims court, and I just lost it. I lost control. And he described his symptoms. And I said, well, he said, my hands started to perspire. I felt nauseated. I felt lightheaded. I couldn't focus. And I said, well, you know, what you're describing is like a panic attack or an anxiety attack. What brought that on? And he could not intellectually make any connection. He found no way to make that connection. So we discussed it for a while longer and finally let it drop and continued on until the next week. Well, he came back the next week and it was still bothering him a great deal. So I said, well, would you be willing to try hypnotherapy? He said, fine. So hypnotized him, took him back to the time. I said, okay, now you're in the courtroom and you're fine. You're very relaxed and nothing wrong with you, but you're standing there. Now tell me what happened. So he began to say that he was standing down below and he looked up and there was this desk above. And that this judge walked out. And I said, well, what did he look like? He said, oh, no, it was a woman. And she had a long black robe on. And she sat down, and I looked up at her. And I said, now just stop for a second and take a deep breath and tell me, where are you? And he went, second grade. He had a very bad experience in a parochial school with a woman who was wearing a long black habit, who stood in front of him, who reached down with a ruler and smacked him on the hand. And he had never forgotten that subconsciously. So here, it's amazing how that, and here's this man who's 45, 46 years old, and, you know, 40 years later, or 40, 39 years later, still deeply embedded in his subconscious mind. So things, you know, so sometimes we have these unexplained feelings that come over us. They're stored memories. And he had stored a lot of that really scary experience for him. So it's like digging that stuff up sometimes, and that's what your conscious mind has to do. And see, once he consciously said, "Oh, well, that's what it is," he was relieved, and that was fine. He said, "Now I can see and appreciate, you know, why I had that reaction." But what was really scaring him, intellectually, he could not find a hook to hang it on, and that's what scares all of us. And if we can't find a reason for our behavior, it's like, why would I have done or said or acted that, you know, if we lose our temper or we respond someplace that somehow we feel is out of the ordinary. It's like, wow, you know, I'm losing control, which is very scary for all of us.
Can the ordinary citizen,
like you and me,
like us guys, can an individual begin to delve into these issues on one's own?
Absolutely.
On his or her own?
Absolutely. And again, sometimes counseling is very important for people if they get stuck in a place. Or I always say that the real measure of if you need counseling or therapy is that if you're working on yourself very hard, you become very discouraged and you don't see you're getting ahead at all, then by all means, you know, seek out something in your community. And there's a lot of things here in your community that are virtually free, if not terribly inexpensive. Or there's pastoral counseling. You don't have to go to a very expensive place to get help. But I think many, many people on their own, because they're interested, can read, can take classes, can get audio cassette tapes are great ways to change your life, because you can hear them again and again and again. It really reinforces what goes on in your subconscious mind. So, yeah, I think that, and particularly today, and we have so many TV shows, we have talk shows like this, we have all kinds of ways that people can have exposure, and that's real important for people.
Once again, we're talking to Dr. Bobbi Sommer. You've tuned into KUAC's Conversations. Among other things, Dr. Sommer is the president of SBU. It's a training and seminar providing company using applied psychology in corporate training and executive training, staff development, those sorts of things. Dr. Sommer is a consultant to such companies as IBM, Intel Corporation, AT&T, Quaker Oats, TRW, all in these ways of corporate and staff development. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. In the area of altering your self-image, say from someone who procrastinates or someone who flies off the handle, are there, since some of the ways we keep ourselves in the old patterns is this talking to ourselves, is it, and I'm not saying it's so simple, but is it a matter also of putting new language in our minds?
Absolutely.
Talking to ourselves in new ways? How do we go about doing that?
Yeah, that's a good question, and one that always comes up in seminars or in counseling is, okay, let's suppose I agree with you that I can change my behavior. Now, how do I do it? I mean, I've had all this past history of having this one particular thought, and the way I have people do it is quite simply is to listen to that intra-psychic dialogue, and when you hear yourself say, "Oh, that's just like me, I'm so clumsy," and you will hear, if you train your ear, you'll hear yourself say, "Oh, that's just like me, I'm so clumsy," that you are to say cancel, and even say it out loud. Saying it out loud completes what we call the language loop. Your lips tell your ears to tell your brain, and you really hear it to yourself. And it's amazing what it does. Of course, in seminars, people always laugh because I'll say things like, standing in line at the bank, you say, cancel. Sitting in your office, cancel. And people that don't know you will try to lock you up, of course. And, and the ones that have heard this broadcast will say, good for you. You're changing a negative thought. You make yourself say cancel. You stop that behavior. And you insert a new tape such as, it's inconvenience. It will inconvenience me, but it's not the end of the world. I'm not exactly the most skillful person, but I'm not clumsy either. And so you give yourself new permission to do that. But so many people don't know that they can really change that intra-psychic dialogue. The theory is this. Anything in my subconscious mind, most things, not everything, but most things in my subconscious mind have been learned. Now, by definition, if I've learned something, it can be unlearned. If it can be unlearned, it can be relearned. And so there we get into, you can teach old dogs new tricks. It's a question of looking at the learning you've had before, unlearning it by saying cancel and stopping the behavior and making yourself, again, more perspiration than anything else, say, wait a minute, I'm not going to allow this to happen. I'm going to change this thought and put something else into it. I'll give you a vivid example. Coming here to Alaska, I flew from where I live in Southern California, flew into Seattle. Now, when they made the announcement, I was on my way to Juneau. They made the announcement. They said we have about a 45 to 50% chance of not landing in Juneau because we can never predict the weather. Now, we're going to get you to Ketchikan and to Sitka, and maybe we'll get you to Juneau, but we can't promise. You may have to go on to Anchorage and return back. Well, the second I heard that announcement, my emotional response is, oh, wouldn't you know it? Wouldn't you just, you know, and I said, stop, cancel. Mm-hmm. If you don't get there tonight, you'll get there the next morning. And I want people to become reasonably concerned about the issues of their life, but not overly explosive. And what happens is we tend to over-embellish things. We make them bigger than life. And, you know, proverbial mountains out of molehills kind of thing. Right. And so I said to myself, now wait, stop, you know. Do the intelligent thing. So I called my travel agent. And I said, okay, if I do go on to Anchorage, what's the first flight back into Juneau? You know, what's the ferry? You know, I looked at my alternatives. And if people would just do that, it saves such anguish. And I looked around me, and maybe the 145, 150 people that were all milling around there, I would say at least 15 to 20% of them were absolutely irate. And they're going up to the counter and they're banging their hands like, your airline has messed up my trip, da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, here they are. And they're reinforcing. They say, it's your fault. You screwed me up. Mm-hmm. And there's that condemning, and it's awful, and I can't stand it. And you can hear those four styles coming out. You know, I don't know why I have to put up with this, and what's wrong with you? And they were blaming this particular airline, which is ridiculous because, you know, you can't mess around with Mother Nature. I mean, you want safety? You want to get there in one piece or what? But it was interesting to see the reactions of people when they're confronted with an obstacle. And my very first, what I call knee-jerk response was, oh, wouldn't you just know it? Da, da, da. And I mean, I went on for maybe 30, 35, 40 seconds. But I've trained myself now to say, cancel. Stop it. Whoa. This is one more event in your life. Now, how do you want to treat this event? And so oftentimes people say, well, that just sounds like a robot or something. And it really isn't, because there's so much of that emotional stuff going on. The emotion's going to bubble up anyway. It's all we can do to pull back and say, wait a minute, whoa, you know, what's the worst that could happen here? You know, and I have people look at what I call their fantasized catastrophe. What's the worst that could really happen? That you may miss a seminar. You know, you may not be able to get to that particular appointment. But you see, if you're reasonable, if you say, okay, I'll make every reasonable adjustment in my life to see what are my alternative plans. If this doesn't work, what else can I do? And by talking to ourselves and doing that, we will really literally calm ourselves down because, and again, Ellis makes this point so beautifully. He says we talk ourselves into being neurotic, frustrated with our irrational beliefs, with our demandingness, with our awfulizing, with our I can't stand it-itis, with our condemning and damning people and things, that becomes such a hand-clasping habit that people just don't even know they're doing it. You know, somebody steps in front of us in a line, again, our knee-jerk response is, well, who do you think you are, you jerk? You know, we get all this condemning behavior. Uh-huh. Rather than saying, excuse me, I believe I was ahead of you. Was there any particular reason why you stepped in front? And oftentimes, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were in line. It's almost always that kind of situation. Once in a while, this man who says, you know, gives you a nasty sign or whatever, and then you deal with that a little bit differently. But most of the time, if you approach people with logic, they tend to respond with logic. If we approach people with irrational thoughts, it provokes more rational thoughts from them as well.
And for you, standing in line, it's not robotic. It's the opposite of that. It feels to me like Ellis and Maltz are saying, take charge of this moment.
That's right.
What can you do here?
That's right, exactly. What are your alternatives at this given moment, since all we have is this moment to work with? How do you choose to deal with this moment? And see, I guess the most important thing that Maltz and Ellis both said is that at all times we really are at choice. It doesn't feel like we're at choice because a lot of our responses are so subconsciously habitualized, we don't even know we're doing it until we stop and say, wait a minute, wait, what am I doing here? We've been so conditioned to say, well, this is how I respond. People do this by guy, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And, you know, we get into that whole kind of vindictiveness behavior. One thing I did find when I was in private practice, which was so interesting, is that the one emotion that seems to kill people, and I mean literally take people out, is resentment. And resentment is something which people tend to hang on to for a long, long time. And if you, of course, if you dig back in the philosophies and any religions, they always say, you know, forgiveness is the key. You know, turn the other cheek in the Christian religion, whatever. And it's always that way. But the truth of the matter is that resentment just keeps festering in people, and it causes a tremendous, tremendous amount of pain in people. So I tell people in my seminars and also in private practice in my writings that if you are carrying any resentment in your life about anything, any place, any time, anywhere, right this very second, just let it go. Just let it slide. Not because you're trying to help the other person, because you're trying to get yourself out of this negative energy flow. Because emotion means energy flowing. Hmm. It means energy in motion. And so if you really
resentments are all bottled up. Right?
Yeah.
It's the same emotion over and over, not making room for the others. Is
exactly.
That?
Yeah. Plus, it colors and really clouds all the other feelings we have in our lives. If people have overriding resentment in their life and they're saying, I will never forgive that person as long as I live because of what they've done to me, da-da. You know, and I say to people, well, all right, you know, did they do it? Yes. Then should they have done it? No. Yes, they should, because they did. I'm not saying was it right or wrong. I'm saying, did it happen? Is it factual? And so people get into, but they shouldn't have and they must. I say, hey, the word must, by definition, means imperative requirement. So if I say, I must pay my bills, no, I don't have to pay my bills. I can go to jail.
I can have consequences.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like saying that life shouldn't be the way it is demanding that the world spin to my tune. And it's never going to do that. So resentment is something which people have got to learn to let go of, because it injures them, not because it's any do-gooder for anybody else, but just to free yourself of all that that negativity, of that negative emotion turning around.
This is Dr. Bobby Summer. We're talking today on Conversations. Okay, so steps to change include knowing this habit is not, whatever this habit is, whether it's a habit of resentment, overeating, smoking, procrastination, doesn't matter. This is a habit I don't want anymore.
Right. I choose not to have this.
I choose not to have this.
See, consciously, I'm selecting not to do this anymore. So that's the first principle of the conscious mind. I'm choosing not to do this. I'm selecting another behavior. That's the first step.
Okay. An equally important step is to know what goes on with you. That is to say, what's in my self-image or my belief system? Mm-hmm. What's on this list that composes Susan McGinnis or Bobby Summer?
Right.
And what are factors on that impede me choosing and actualizing this change?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And then why am I resisting that so much? And a lot of it's because we've never experienced anything else.
Something new. If I go over middle management, I'll fall off a cliff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or it'll only validate that my father was right. You know, we all wear these T-shirts in life that say, I'm this or I'm that, and Susan's this and Bobby's that. And we unconsciously try to validate those T-shirts. So if my T-shirt says, I'm not very good at athletics, never was, never will be. I'm very clumsy. I have two left feet. I'll never be able to dance well. What are my T-shirts?
Yeah.
Exactly. They want T-shirts. That I will unconsciously elicit from people around me. And the second you say something about my dancing, I'll say, oh, Susan, you're right. I know I can't dance. I never could. And we pick up on those little cues, the environment we hear. You know, this whole thing about selective perception is very, very true. We, you know, the other thing about seeing is believing. No, believing is seeing. And we hear what we think we're going to hear. We hear that which we're programmed to hear. So it's fascinating how when you begin to step to change, is you have to become kind of multi-aware. And as I say, although it's a simple process, it's not easy. And it's very, very doable if people will sit down. And one of the things I tell people to do if you're really serious about changing is to sit down and just write down, what are a few of the habits that I have that either I'm aware of or my friend Susan said, Bobby, you were the fact that you just said, and feedback from other people, people who you feel are credible in your life. And write down one or two of the three of the habits or the behavioral traits that you are currently doing that you don't like. For one reason, perhaps it's holding you back at work. Your performance reviews tell you, hey, you know, and it wasn't just one boss, it was four bosses in a row that said, you have a so-called attitude problem, doesn't get along well with others, doesn't relate well. And, of course, the first thing we do is dismiss it and say, oh, well, that's not true. But if you get it from two or three different sources, it's a real good indication that somebody's reading those signals that way. Mm-hmm. So write down what are the habits that either you yourself have identified that you want to change, or that several people in the environment, possibly in different places, have given you feedback. There's a difference between negative feedback and corrective feedback. Negative feedback is when people say, well, I don't like you, never have and never will, or, gee, it's just your attitude, Susan, shape up, and they don't give you any specifics. But corrective feedback is, Bobby, you are aware of the fact that when you just said that to Susan, this is what happened. And, you know, and so that's giving me a mirroring back of myself that I don't see. We don't see these parts of ourselves oftentimes, or it takes us a long time to see them. So the steps to change are to, number one, write down some of the habits that you think you formed or that other people have told you. And then on the other side of the paper, what has been your so-called payoff? When I get angry and yell and scream, it relieves my tension and I feel better momentarily. And then the third column is, what would it look like if I did it differently? What are some of the alternative plans I could do? And it makes people kind of be more consciously aware in that kind of a left brain, mm-hmm. rational, linear approach to pull the emotions back into alignment. And it really helps significantly to have people sit down and do that. It changes your whole life, as a matter of fact.
Sit down, write it down. Sit down and write down what your payoffs are for all those things. Mm-hmm. And then sit down and write down,
what are the alternative plans
you
could have taken?
What else I can do?
Yeah. What else could you possibly think? And so I call it having a brainstorming session with yourself. What else could you have done mm-hmm. under these conditions? Again, I go back to the example of the people in the Seattle airport where they heard about the possible landing or not landing in Juneau. And you could just see the people who had such poor emotional control mm-hmm. and their self-discipline was so bare-bone that their whole thing was to strike out, to become explosive. And no one looked for the alternatives. I mean, the second I heard that, of course, I had a knee-jerk response first, and then I stopped that immediately, said cancel, and walked right over to the telephone and called my 800 number to find out what are my alternatives. You know, what's the next step here? Is there a ferry? There's got to be somewhere to get there. And so it's like knowing that you can give yourself a built-in sense of alternatives to reach out to.
This whole process has to be very forgiving.
Absolutely. I mean,
every time you blow off the handle, if we're talking about it like an airport situation, mm-hmm. which happens to you repeatedly,
right.
You have to be able to stop and say, it's okay, Bobby.
That's right.
It's all right.
That's right. You know, that's one more event that life has given you to deal with. Now, mm-hmm. what do you intend to do with the event? Because, see, and Ellis makes his point so beautifully. He says, we get into the habit of saying, you know, again, you did it. Boy, this particular airline really messed me up this time, and they've ruined my trip and all this kind of stuff. And there's just a part of you that's got to stop and say, wait a minute, where's my reality check here? Do I really believe this airline was really out to get me? I mean, am I really that paranoid that I think that? Because this really, to challenge yourself is the biggest challenge of change, is to listen to your own intrapsychic dialogue and challenge that. And ask yourself, is this the way you want your life to go? You know, if you're real happy with what you got, keep on doing it. There's a great saying I oftentimes quote to people, and that is, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. Which is a great statement, you know. Keep on doing the same thing, you'll keep on getting the same results. And so for those of us who really want to change mm-hmm. habits, you know, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. And change that and say, hey, I don't want to always get this ending. I'm not pleased with this particular part of my life. Mm-hmm. And not that I'm making myself wrong for it, but I give myself enough credit to realize if I don't like it, I'm the person that can change it. And the real strength here is to say, rather than saying that this person out here is making me miserable, and the majority of people in the world really believe that. We have real mixed signals here. We really believe that somebody out there is making my life miserable. And really, all that person's really doing is presenting me with a series of events. And that I can choose then to make myself miserable or not make myself miserable. And the key here is, to me, the real strength of this, is if I say, this person is making me miserable, then who in fact runs my life? who has the power in my life is that other person to whom I've just given all my power. I just said, you make me miserable, or you ruined my whole day when you said that, or you spoiled my whole birthday party, or all the things we say about this. The more correct statement is, I'm giving you the power to present me with an event that I will now make myself miserable about myself.
And which is a statement we'd never make.
Exactly. But you know what? I'm seeing that there are a lot of young parents that are parenting their children in a whole different set of values by saying, rather, they hear themselves saying, now see what you've done. They'll say, wait, excuse me. Your behavior I find unacceptable because. And they give the child a rational reason. And the kid will come back and say things like, Mom, when you said that, I really upset myself because. And they could actually come back. And I think it's a whole new generation of teaching children self-responsibility and owning of feelings, because that's where it's really at. You know, and then you can't really cop a plea anymore. You can't say, well, it really wasn't my fault because Susan asked me that question. She upset me. She hurt my feelings. When the truth of the matter is, Susan asked me a question, and I responded, I put value on that, and then I upset myself about it.
The better you teach yourself, the better you begin to learn these new ways to respond. Are there declining periods of time in which you do the behavior you've decided is negative? Am I making myself clear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you get better at this?
Yeah. Yes. Thank God we do. Because I'll give you, let's go back to our hand clasping example when you intertwined your fingers a certain way. Now, the behaviorists have told us that if you did this, and let's say you have a habit of reading a book every evening for an hour, watching TV for an hour, if you set aside that same hour to do your routine thing, and you force yourself to fold your hand in the opposite direction every day for about 6 weeks, at the end of 6 weeks, either of these would feel perfectly comfortable. It's like folding your arms across your chest. You always do it one way. But if you made yourself do it the opposite way every day for 6 weeks, habits do change. So, yeah, there is a law of diminishing returns. You get to a certain point, and if you hear yourself say, cancel, enough, it'll become as automatic as saying, no, Susan, you made me angry. Mm. It'll become as automatic to say, Susan, I really feel unhappy with that remark, and let me tell you what I thought that meant. It's again, if it can be learned, it can be unlearned, it can be relearned. And there does come a point where your subconscious mind will become so ingrained with the new way of thinking that, just like myself with the airport incident, yeah, there's a twinge of, oh, wouldn't you know it, Murphy's Law. You know, the part of that old conditioning kind of rears up in me. But it takes me a very short period of time now to pull it back and say, wait a minute. Let's look at the alternatives. Let's go to the intelligent thing. So, with practice over time, yeah. I mean, with people who really apply this stuff in their life, if they don't see a significant difference in 6 to 8 weeks, something's wrong. Because most people do. I mean, and I'm saying, again, it isn't a magical wand. It doesn't happen overnight. But it does incrementally get easier and easier. And then you get to a place called a quantum leap, where you really get to the place where it's so much easier just to say, well, okay, there's no point in my getting irate over the situation. It's not going to change it. Now, am I feeling unhappy about it? Yes. Would I rather it be a different way? Yes. Would I desire it differently? Yes. But should it be this way? Yes, because it is. Mm-hmm. Therefore, what is, and I'll deal with that. And so it's like the person who makes himself deal with the reality that they perceive at the time. That's, to me, the key of real personal happiness.
Ellis and Maltz both say that when you are at that point of learning, the world opens up.
Mm-hmm.
All the options which you thought closed to you really do march right up and come back to your plate again.
Absolutely. And that's what's so exciting about watching people go through this process called change. Because you do get to that place when you want to call it a quantum leap or whatever you call that thing that happens to you. It's like suddenly you go, oh, could have had a V8. You know? It's like suddenly coming together. Uh-huh. And you see, oh, my gosh, I do see this. Matter of fact, when I got off the phone in the airport at Seattle, I was walking past this one woman who was watching me, and she said to me, are you going to Juneau? And I said, yes. She said, what's going to happen if the plane doesn't land? And I said, well, I just checked out the alternatives. She said, how'd you do that? It's like, and it was like a new awareness for her. And I told her, I wrote the thing down for her, and she said, well, thank you. I said, yeah, absolutely. He said, well, it'll happen if it doesn't happen. And it's like, I think for her, that was like a sudden awareness of, boy, there's another way to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another place, and there's another way to deal with life. You know, you can stand there and say, it shouldn't happen to me. So what? It did. You can't change what's already happened to you. So, you know, the old thing about going with the what is still very powerful and very good advice.
Is there anything else besides what we've said? And I know this just opens up a huge door, but besides what we've said in the last hour that is most important for changing behaviors, for opening up your life in this way?
Yeah, I guess my soapbox is that resentment thing. Really look at your life very carefully, because resentment blocks that emotional flow of everything else in your life. And if you hear resentment in your interpsychic dialogue, like, how dare you? Who do you think you are after all I've done for you? You know, giving the best years of my life. That martyrdom syndrome, I think, is probably one of the most significantly negative things that people do to themselves. It blocks love out of their life. And so if you want more love to come to your life, what's the old saying? If you want to get love, give love. You've got to be real open to being able to say, and again, not because you're an altruistic, all-loving, giving human being, but because you want to free yourself of those shackles. So I think this main step for me in change is listen to your self-talk. And when you hear resentment or anger or I can't stand it-itis or demandingness or it shouldn't be that way, just say cancel and say, yeah, I don't like it that way, and it is the way it is. So given what is, I'll deal with it differently. So changing that whole way that we talk to ourselves is, it's, to me, incredibly powerful.
And when do you seek help? Is it when you're up against a wall for yourself?
Well, yeah. And let me give people kind of a rough thing of when do you seek some kind of professional help? There's a couple of what we call danger signs to look for. Number one, do you have a change of sleep pattern? You're either sleeping too much, you're not sleeping well enough at all, or you're having a lot of insomnia. Number two, if you find yourself being irrational, erratic, if you find yourself having what we call mood swings, crying jags for some people, numbness, I just don't care anymore. That what's it all about, Alfie, and is that all there is, and that whole kind of syndrome. These are what we call the soft signs of depression. And that's a good time for you to say, okay, write down all the things that you're experiencing in your life. And if you have several symptoms like that, it's really time to, number one, either call your family physician, discuss it with him or her, go to an outreach program, pick up the telephone. There's tons of free things too you can call, right here in Fairbanks to get a hold of what's going on in your life. So take control of your life. If you see it's getting out, and also if your friends are telling you, Susan, you're just not yourself lately. Mm. And you hear from four or five different sources, one at work, a neighbor, a friend, the person at the checkout counter, then you've got to look for those. There's something going on, and that something is not right in your life. So seek out help when you find the physical symptoms occurring of your eating, your sleeping, your irritability factors, greater than usual kind of thing. Those are things to really look for.
And real briefly, it seems to me that if you're making a major change in your life, mm-hmm. John, going for middle management,
right,
weight loss, anything that is a regular habit in your mm-hmm. life that you want to change, that some of these emotional problems, signs of depression, will come up.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you're disrupting the pattern.
That's right.
Right.
They will. And then what we ask them is, okay, we're looking for situationally specific versus chronic ongoing. So if you say, okay, well, I've recently put myself into a position where I'm going to be stretching my limits in my work, then we say, okay, hey, it's okay that you're having sleep interruption. That's normal. We expect that. You have a little appetite change, fluctuation. That's to be expected. Now, if it goes on past 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks, 2 months is a long time. If you haven't integrated the change at that point, then you haven't gotten past the obstacle. Then it's still time to go in for some kind of corrective maneuver, because something is very badly wrong. The human body, the human psyche is so wonderful. It corrects itself. And within 6 weeks, most people have turned that pattern around. And if you haven't, then it's a good red flag that says, okay, get some help.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Dr. Bobby Sommer, I want to thank you for a very interesting hour. If you're interested in reading more, now these books are old. There will be a new one coming out, A New Guide to Rational Living. I've been carrying around since the 60s. It first came out in 1961. Robert A. Harper, Ph.D., and Albert Ellis, one of the best-known psychologists in America today. That book was originally published by Prentice Hall, and your library probably has it. Psycho-Cybernetics came out in 1960 and in 1969 again. Dr. Maxwell Maltz, M-A-L-T-Z, is the author of that. And coming out, we trust, sometime soon by Dr. Bobby Sommer, a rewrite of that book, Psycho-Cybernetics 2000. When do you estimate it might be out?
Well, we're hoping, we're planning on it for...
Definite stuff.
Plan possibly for early 1992.
All right. Mm-hmm. Look for it. Dr. Bobby Sommer, thanks for joining us.
You bet. My pleasure.
Good. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations, and we'll talk to you again next week.